so they wouldn't take it. It's a Israel technology. They don't want this anymore.
The Parsha Vayetze follows Yaakov as he goes into Golus. And from a certain point of view, it's certainly one of the Maisei Avos for the experience of Golus. And the opening Pasuk, Per Kavches Pasuk, Yud Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Shova Vayelech Charona. And Rashi comments on the words Vayelech Charona. Most of the attention Rashi-wise goes on the Vayetze Rashi, Yotza Tzadik Min Ha'ir, and we've spoken about that in the past. But there's a short comment of Rashi, tucked in there at the end, Vayelech Charona. Rashi comments, Yotza Laleches Lecharon. He left to go to Charon. And it's an interesting Rashi, because it seems to be rather straightforward to the extent that we're somewhat intrigued. Ma ba Rashi lelamdenu. Vayelecharon, yotza leleches lecharon. What is Rashi's point? What is he coming to resolve? What is there about the words vayelecharon that say darsheni? Well, Mefarshi Rashi point out that the words themselves, vayelecharon, are not problematic in and of themselves. The problem is, no sooner has it said Vayelech Harona, as the next pasuk says Vayivka Bamokom, which is something that happened before he got to Haran. Now, if we would be inclined to say that Vayelech Harona means, and he went to Haran, incorporating and including his arrival at Haran, and then the pasuk goes on to describe something that happened before he got to Haran, then in a sense, we're going backwards. We are moving in the opposite direction and filling in information that happened prior to that. And that is not something that Rashi is prepared to do. As if to say, because the Pasuk would then read, Yaakov left Beersheba, he went to Haran, but before he went to Haran, this happened. If it happened before, it should be mentioned before. And this Rashi is dealing with when he explains and renders the words Vayelech Harona means Yotza Laleches Lecharona. According to Rashi, the words Vayelech Harona do not refer to and do not include and incorporate his arrival. They don't mean he went to Haran. They mean he went towards Haran, Laleches Lecharona, which means that by the time Pasuk Yud is finished, he is still on the way. And then on the way, Vayivka Bamakom, so the Psukim are in chronological sequence. Rashi actually, in avoiding this Peirush, is avoiding the Peirush of the Ibn Ezra, because this is exactly how the Ibn Ezra explains the Psukim. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, he left Be'er Sheva, Vayelech L'Charon, he went to Charon, Vayivka B'Mokom, but that said, before he got to Charon, this happened. So as the Psukim go forward, we go backwards. Ukvar, right, this is what happened along the way. And Rashi is looking to avoid that by Vayelech Charon, not so much in arriving there, but just setting the direction of Yaakov. That said, we should note that as much as Rashi is clearly looking to avoid this explanation, it is the type of explanation that Rashi himself has used. It has happened. And in fact, a classic example is in the beginning of Parshas Vayera, perhaps more extreme, in the sense that the beginning of Vayera, Avram Avinu, is Pesach HaOhel. And then he sees these three men, and he runs towards them. Pasuk Bey says, there are three people there. And he runs towards them, which means by the time Pasuk Beis is finished, he's there. He's already with them. He's bowed down to them. He's about to speak to them. The next Pasuk says, and if we know the Pasuk with Rashi, it's actually hard to translate it, to read it even. because there's a machlokas as to who he's talking to. But according to Rashi's first parish, the next pasuk is Vayomer Hashem imno matasi chen beinecha anotavo me'alavdecha. If I found favor in your eyes, please do not pass on from me. And Rashi explains that he is talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as if to say that I'm about to deal with the Orchim. He's in the middle of communing with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Please don't move away. I'll deal with them. And then I'll be right back. From here we learn, Gedolach Nosas Orchim Yosef Mikabolas Pnei Hashchina. Now, it must be true, according to that understanding, that the contents of Pasuk Gimel were said in between the two halves of Pasuk Beis. Because Pasuk Beis has him seeing these three men, that's the first half. The second half has him arriving there and already bowing down to them, ready to speak. Pasuk Beis was said before he moved away towards the three men. And Rashi himself says that even though it's out of order, we find that Ein Haseder Meduktak B'Mikra, the Pasuk is not always makpid on the chronological order. This is a bigger chiddush than usual, because normally when we say Ein Mukdama Me'ucha B'Torah, we can say that a certain section is written afterwards, but it happened before, Pesach Sheni happened first, etc., etc. Here we're saying that the later Pasuk happened in between two halves of the earlier Pasuk. That's quite an insertion. And so it is. And in a sense, Rashi's explanation there is along the lines of the Ibn Ezra here. He went to meet them and bow down to them, and then the next pasuk says, and prior to having done that, he said the following to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it can be done. And Rashi himself has explained Psukim in that way. But all things being equal, he prefers to explain that Vayelech Haronah just gives us the direction so that the chronological sequence is preserved. That said, we should note that perhaps there's another way of relating to this opening pasuk, which would deal with our problem. Namely, Rashi himself has told us in Parshas Bereishis that one of the ways the Torah presents things to us, presents matters to us, is in the presentation of klal v'achar kach prat. As if to say the Torah will first present something generally and then give us its details. Now, if that's true, and the classic example is Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz, which is about as general as it gets. And then the pasuk goes on then to give all of the details. If that's the case, then perhaps if we consider carefully, maybe the we could diffuse the problem of the first pasuk of Vayetzeh, even if we say that it means he arrived at Choron. But that's a klal. That's the opening pasuk as the story in one sentence. And then it goes back to give you all of the pratim. So that there's no violation of the chronological sequence, because by definition, every klal will obviously extend beyond the first detail, beyond the first prat. That's not a problem. And therefore, why not look at the beginning of Vayetzeh as klal? The beginning of Vayetzeh is when Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and went to Haran. That's the klal. Now, pratim, we begin with the details of his journey. Says the Be'er Yitzchak, the reason why we may have this question is because we may have overlooked a pasuk in the end of Parshas Toldos. Everything is so tense in the end of Toldos, there are certain psukim that perhaps we don't give due attention to. But pasuk Hey of Perek Kavches, Vayishlach Yitzchak es Yaakov. Yitzchak sends Yaakov away. Vayelech Padena Aram, and he went to Padan Aram. Elavon ben Besuel Harami, Achi Rivka, Eim Yaakov ve'Esav. So what's interesting is, says the Be'er Yitzchak, should we ask the question, well, isn't there a concept that the Torah first tells you something generally, and then it tells you the details? Couldn't that be true here? The answer, says Be'er Yitzchak, is no. It can't be true here. There is such a concept. It's already happened. The klal pasuk has already been stated in the end of Toldos, which said, Yitzchak sent Yaakov to Padan Aram, to Lavan's house. That's the klal. Everything from here on is pratim. And that being the case, we have no choice. All other options are now exhausted. we have no choice but to explain that Vayelech Harana means that he went towards Haran. And along the way, this happened. All the details are in sequence. We should know that according to some, this is perhaps even a confirmation of a certain principle. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky is of the opinion that the very usage of the letter hey, and we take it for granted that whenever there's you could have put a lamed before the word, put a hey at the end of the word, and they mean approximately the same thing. But do they mean exactly the same thing? No. According to Rabbi Yaakov, the difference between them is if there ever the Torah ever writes with a lamed at the beginning or L, then that will always mean that he got there wherever he was going. But the hey at the end of the word is a much broader expression of moving in that direction without necessarily arriving there. It doesn't necessarily have the connotation. That's what the hey means. And in fact, he uses this idea to explain a very interesting Rashi in Parshas Chayesara. Rivka has gone out, right, v'kado al shechma, and Eliezer sees her, right, says Eliezer sees her, and he runs up to her and asks her for water. The question is, of all the girls, why does he run up to her? Now, the answer, one could say, is in the Pasuk. I mean, for what it's worth, the Pasuk says that v'anara tovas mar'eh, etc., etc., and perhaps she looked nicer than anybody else. So, all things being equal, I mean, that's where to start. The Pasuk did say it. It obviously means a great deal. But Rashi says something else. Rashi says the reason why he ran up to her is because shera hamayim olu likrasa. He saw that this is no ordinary girl. When she went down to the well, the water came up to her. She's probably the one to start with. Interestingly, as the Balei Musaf point out, even having seen that, it didn't obviate or render obsolete the requirement to see if she's a Balas Chesed. She didn't get in based on that miracle alone. It's a good place to start, but she still has to deliver the goods, which she did. How do we see, where is it alluded to in the Pasuk that the water came up to meet her? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Pasuk says, with regards to Rivka, Vatered ha'ayna. She went down, well, ha'ayna, we would have said, means to the spring. But the hey at the end of ha'ayna indicates that she went in the direction of the spring, but not all the way there. Well, how is she possibly going to get water if she doesn't go all the way to where the water is, unless the water actually came up to meet her? And therefore, says Rabbi Yaakov, that's the yesod in the pasuk for the drush of Chazal, melamed shamayim olu likrosa. So that's a very interesting principle, and now we have a tool with which to work through Torah, to consider the hay at the end, as opposed to the either lamed at the beginning or the word el. So Yaakov is on the way, and he has his dream, and at the end he makes a neder, and it's interesting to note that there is a certain halacha, or at the very least a base for a halacha that is derived from Yaakov's dream, and it's to be found towards the end, as he says, just before Sheni, the final pasuk of Perek Kafches. So he's already said he's had his dream, Malachei Elokim, Olim v'yordim bo, and Hashem says he's going to look after him. And then the final thing that Yaakov says is, V'ha Evin Hazos, Asher Samti Matzeva, Yebeis Elokim. He pledges that this rock will be the basis of Beis Elokim. In the end, he turned it into a Mizbeach. V'chol Asher Titen Li Aser Asrenu Lach. Anything, everything you give to me, I will tithe, Maestros. Now, of course, the expression is double, aser asrenu, and that's awkward always, and translating into English only makes it worse, because we bring in the word surely, which does almost nothing. It perhaps offers emotional support, but it doesn't give any further insight. Presumably, Yaakov is quite sure of everything that he says, as indeed is the Torah. And therefore, Aser Asrenu Loch is actually the allusion to a takona. Now, there's a takona that is referred to in Maseches Ksubis and Daf Nun Amud Aleph with regards to tzedakah. How much tzedakah should a person give? Well, of course, the desired amount is meiser. There's a question as to whether that's an actual obligation or it's a hanhaga tova. But what is a person? Is there any upper limit? Says the Gemara, there is. And not only is there an upper limit, but there was actually an enactment to enforce that people do not go beyond this limit. Ad kedei kach. I'm not sure if it was a widespread issue, it's a widespread problem, that people were giving too much tzedakah. But in Usha, and Usha was one of the places that the Sanhedrin moved to, Eser Golias, Golsa Sanhedrin, from Yerushalayim, one of the places was Usha. Be'usha itkinu. In Usha they instituted, and the expression is very interesting, it's a well-known enactment, ha'mevazbez ayevazbez yoser michomesh. A person who spends his money, we use the concept bizbuz in the sense to squander money. That's hardly appropriate. It's a reference to, it's not a correct translation here, because it's a reference to tzedakah. But a person who dispenses money, ayivazbez yosem michomesh. And where did they base it on? Yaakov Avinu says, aser aasrenu. Aser aasrenu, says the Gemara, means two maisras, two tenths, equals one fifth, and that's it. No more. Good enough for Yaakov, good enough for you. Now, the rationale behind the takana, which actually is referred to by Rishonim, is that a person may end up himself giving too much, so to speak, and he will lose his economic viability and perhaps himself become a recipient of tzedakah. Maybe he will be mitzdarech lebrios. In other words, if he gives too much and he has no sense of proportion, so perhaps he will end up to be his own financial undoing. And instead of being a giver, he'll end up being a receiver. And therefore, he needs to maintain a certain sense of perspective. Al yivazbez yosem michomesh. The Vilna Gaon, in his classic approach to these things, shows a further allusion. Interestingly, I mean, it's already alluded to. But the Gaon says, in the beginning of Parshas Kisisa, when we have the Machzis HaShekel, and there, it says he asher lo yarbeh. The rich man shouldn't give more. He asher lo yarbeh. Now the Vilna Gaon was of the approach that the Tamei HaMikra, the cantillation, what we call the trop, is not only there to teach you how to sing the pasuk, but it is also Tamei HaMikra. It gives insight into the pasuk. All of the Tamei HaMikra have names, and the words he'ashir le'yarbeh are accompanied by the ta'amim munach revi'i. He'ashir is munach, and revi'i is on top of the word yarbeh. And says the Gaon, in Aderes Elio, that's a remez to the fact that a person shouldn't give more than a fifth. Namely, even if he's ashir le'yarbeh, even if he's rich, le'yarbeh, not too much. Whatever he gives, for every part that he gives, munach revi'i. There should be four parts left for him. He shouldn't give more than a fifth. It happens to be that the Chofetz Chaim in the Sefer Avas Chesed does say that if a person is exceedingly wealthy, the type of person that actually could not become poor, even if they tried, so to speak, then they are not bound by this restriction. But every person, of course, has to rate their own situation, and halavai, we should all have problems like this. But the principle is no more than 20%. Rabbi Yosef Engel, who wrote many, many works, in the Sefer Beis HaOtzar, has a simple question. She'elas tam. Here we are, on some level, deriving a halacha from the words of Yaakov Avinu. He said, Aser Asrenu Lach, we take that to mean two maisras equals 20%, and from there, everybody learns. There's just one problem. There is a Yerushalmi, in Maseches Moed Katan, in the third perek, which gives us a very interesting principle. Namely, we do not derive halachas from before Matan Torah. The Yerushalmi says this within the context of Aveilus Der, Lo Aleinu, that's the third perek of Moed Katan, and someone in the Yerushalmi sought to learn certain halachas of Avelus from Yosef, from the way that Yosef conducted himself in Avelus for his father. And on that, the Yerushalmi says, Ein lemeidim mikodem matan Torah. Now, if that's true, then Rabbi Yosef Engel asked the question, so why is it that we are all comfortable deriving this principle from Yaakov Avinu? He was also Kodem Matan Torah. Why do we go ahead with that and take our cue from Yaakov? So Rabbi Yosef Engel answers that question in classic fashion by asking another question. Namely, why is it true that we do not learn from things that happened before Matan Torah, after all? Or is it not also part of the Torah to some degree? So if you wish to understand how this could be an exception, we need to appreciate the background to the principle, to the general rule. Why is it true that we do not learn from before Matan Torah? The simple answer is, says Rabbi Yosef Engel, that life as we know it changed dramatically and fundamentally with the giving of the Torah. The spiritual climate and the halachic climate changed. There are certain things that may have been acceptable or even desirable before Matan Torah because there was not yet the program of 613 mitzvahs. Once the Torah has been given, you don't know that conditions would allow for those practices to be upheld. We don't know, and therefore, if we don't know, we can't derive from before Matan Torah. But because that's true, we cannot assume of ourselves. But what if we had unreliable information that this practice that we see being inaugurated before Matan Torah is also meant to apply to us after Matan Torah? What if we knew? Well, says Rabbi Yosef Engel, if the whole reason why we don't know is because we don't know that things are the same, then in any instance that we do know, so then we know. And we would have no reservations or hesitations of keeping it on. And such an example, to quote a famous example, is Shacharis Mincha and Ma'ariv. Everybody knows that the earliest institution of Shacharis Mincha and Ma'ariv is with the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And indeed, there is an opinion in the Gemara which holds that that is the halachic basis of three tefillos a day, Shacharis Mincha and Ma'ariv. Says Rabbi Yosef Engel, but if we ask the question, but I mean, the Avos are before Matan Torah, how can we learn anything from them? But except the Gemara says, Tefilos Avos Tiknum. The Avos instituted Tefilos. If they instituted them for all generations, that means that when it comes to these Tefilos, you now know that they are meant to last. If they're meant to last, so then we keep them. That's an example of knowing. An example closer to home. The halacha has a rather ambivalent relationship with the concept of nedarim. The pasuk in Koheles, the famous pasuk, better that you shouldn't take a neder than you should take it and don't fulfill it. And there is an opinion amongst the Tanoim that it's better not to take it even to take it and fulfill it. It's better to leave the whole thing alone. It's very interesting as to why the concept of nedarim is there in the first place. But the Tosos tell us in the beginning of Maseches Chulin that there are certain circumstances where it is proper to take a neder. And one of them is the Eis Tzara. If a person is in, lo aleinu, is in difficult circumstances, it is appropriate. We no longer have this lukewarm relationship with nedarim, and it's encouraged, and it's a good thing. He should have no pangs of conscience about taking a neder. It's a good thing. Where do we learn it from? The first person to take a neder be'es tzara is Yaakov Avinu. In the beginning of Vayetze, Vayidar Yaakov neder le'mor. Because he was be'es tzara. And now the question is, well, once again, Yaakov did that. That was before Matan Torah. Is it still advisable? To the same degree? Says the Medrash, yes. How do we know? Because the Pasuk tells us. Commenting on the words Vayidar Yaakov Neder Leimor. That extra word Leimor also will always need understanding. What is the meaning of Leimor after all? I mean, who is it to say? Leimor means to say. What is the meaning within this pasuk? Vayidar Yaakov neder, he took a neder. What's the word lemor? Lemor, says the Medrash, means he took a neder. Lemor, and this is something for others to say. Likewise, if they are in a similar circumstance. That's an amazing understanding of the word lemor. Lemor means this Yaakov did it, and he showed the way for others. Others should also say something like this, if they are in similar circumstances. And thus, we derive from Yaakov the positive concept of Nodrim Be'est Sarah. Says Rabbi Yosef Engel, if that is the case, then permit me to take things just one step further. After all, if we have already seen that the word Lemor is an indication from Yaakov that what he is about to say is for all time, and it's recommended and even encouraged based on this pasuk, then perhaps it is the understanding of Takanas Usha that the Lemor covers not only the concept of making a neder based tzara, but it also underwrites all of the contents of that neder, which concluded with the words Aser Asrenu Loch, which gives us the basis of no more than 20%. And therefore, says Rabbi Yosef Engel, should we ask the question, how do we know that what Yaakov said is true for us? The answer is, if the Lemor covers everything, it covers this as well. And thus, in the Sanhedrin in Usha, they had no problem drawing a straight line from Yaakov's words to normative practice. So these are some of the ha'aros with regards to Yaakov's dream there and his subsequent neder. Now he makes his way to Lavan's house, and there Lavan says to him, you're not going to work for me for nothing, which is Lavan's way of saying, you're definitely going to work for me. So what is your Hagidah Nima Maskotecha? And then Pasuk Tetzayin, Perikav Tesu Pasuk Tetzayin. Ule Lavan Shtei Bonos. Lavan has two daughters. Shema Gdola Lea Veshema Ketana Rachel. Lea and Rachel. And then says Pasuk Yud Zayin. Ve'einei Lea Rakos. Translate as accurately as we can. Leah's eyes were soft. Rachel was beautiful in appearance. So the Torah's description of Rachel is easier to understand. It's happened before. It's true. It's been said of Sarah. It's been said of Rivka. It's now said of Rachel. What the Torah says about Leah, of course, needs a further investigation. Ve'einei Leah Rakos. What is that to teach us? In fact, even just before we get to specific interpretations, is it even meant in a positive way? Well, the Ibn Ezra, we should note, quotes a contemporary commentator of his time, who I do not think he held in very high regard, called Ben Ephraim. And he quoted him because, I guess, if he didn't quote him, there would be letters to the editor, but he clearly does not value greatly his comments. But he quotes him to dismiss them sometimes. Ben Ephraim, he says, explains, what does it mean? Rakos, they're soft, what does that mean? So Ben Ephraim suggested that the word rakos is choser aleph. In other words, sometimes you find that the Torah, because Aleph in a sense is a letter that can be dropped on occasion, so the word should be read as if it had an Aleph. Like, for example, Eretz HaMaria, some say, is Eretz HaEmaria. That's the Rashbam says that. And therefore, according to Ben Ephraim, Einei Lea Rakos is Chaser Aleph, as if it's with an Aleph, which then means Arukos. In other words, her eyes were long. Okay, or wide. Otherwise, you can't make sense of the pasuk. Okay, the Ibn Ezra's comment on that parish of Ben Ephraim is that he says that the word rakos is chaser aleph vihine hoya hukach. In other words, if you take Ben Ephraim and delete the Aleph from him, you'll more or less get a sense of how highly the Ibn Ezra regarded the author of this Perush. Ephraim becomes Parim, and Ben Parim pretty much says it all. Unculus, interestingly, translated positively. In the words of Unculus, ve'eni le'a rakos, ve'eni le'a ya'ayon. Now that comes from the word ya'e, ki lo na'e, ki lo ya'e. In other words, her eyes were beautiful. Perhaps in contrast to Rachel, it was a distinctive feature of Leah as opposed to Rachel, who was entirely beautiful, perhaps. But nonetheless, it is a positive statement. But Rashi follows the Gemara in Maseches Bava Basra in Kuf Kaf Gimel, in Perkei Shnochlin. Because the Gemara is troubled. The way the Gemara introduces its astonishment. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't even speak ill of an animal that's impure. As we know from Parshas Noach, he will go out of his way to say behema shel einena tahorahi instead of saying tamei. So if the pasuk, it seems rakos doesn't really sound like such an attractive feature. So why is the pasuk highlighting it? What can it mean? Rather, says the Gemara, no, it is a positive feature, even though perhaps it didn't look very nice, because Leah's eyes were not naturally that way; they became that way because of something that Leah did. She heard through the grapevine, it was known somehow that there's two of them, her and Rachel, and there's Yitzchak and Rivka have two sons, Esav and Leah, and she's the oldest. And v'hayu omrim, and they were saying, hagadola legodol v'aktana lekatan. The default is that she will marry the older one. She found out just a few things about Esav, and she would cry constantly that she should not have to marry Esav. And we see from the Medrash that this was not just something that people were saying. It sounds like she really was intended for Esav. To understand, by way of background, Esav himself could have become part of the future of the Jewish people. The Medrash Bereishis Rabbah says that of the 12 tribes of Bnei Yisrael, 6 of them were originally intended to come from Esav. He could have overcome his difficulties and yet become part of the program. But he did not. The question is, so where does that leave Leah? In a terrible situation. And she cried and cried until her eyes were soft, and apparently they stayed that way. When a person cries, their eyes can become puffy for a while, and then the next day they're back to themselves. They stayed that way, apparently, which means that she couldn't stop crying. And the Medrash says, Gedolot tefillah shemibateles is a gezeira. There was a gezeira. That is to say, that was how things were meant to be. And it had to be undone. And she succeeded in doing it. And that, the Torah highlights in her praise. Even though, physically, now her eyes don't look that attractive, but they are the eyes of a tzaddikus, who couldn't stop crying. She shouldn't have to marry someone like Esav. What's interesting is to see how these worlds intersect. The Chasam Sofer says, that is what Unculus means when he says that Leah's eyes were beautiful. Because if a person's eyes have gone soft from so much crying that she shouldn't have to marry Russia, and then she should be able to marry a tzaddik, then those are beautiful eyes. And to the uninformed observer, they may not look particularly attractive, but he has no concept of beauty. And he says this actually in the base of a halachic statement. Because in those days, arba minim were very hard to come by. And of course, nowadays we're spoiled for choice, but there could be one esrog for shared between however many people. Each person has to own it for their time. And someone asked them the question that everyone is always looking out for hadar, and there was one esrog that so many people had used it that it actually it looked worn. It didn't really look fresh anymore. I mean, it'd be handled by hundreds of people, the whole kehila. And there was this other esrog that, you know, was fresh on the scene. And everybody's looking for Hidur. And the Chasam Sofer says a person should go out of his way to use the one that everyone has used. Because that's an Esrog Mehudar. and his raya is from Leah. If it looks that way, because so many people have performed a mitzvah with it, that is a beautiful thing. That's hadar. More than the fresh-looking Esra. One needs to know exactly how to quantify and where the boundaries are. But it's a very interesting principle. And Unkela says, she made her eyes look that way. That's a beautiful thing. Now, this background, which perhaps we don't normally take into account, as Leah marries Yaakov, there is a certain distance between them. We have to obviously be very careful how we describe it. The Torah itself talks about it in different ways at different times. It says on the one hand, Vayehavis Rachel mi Leah, he loved Rachel more than Leah, which can't be true unless he loved Leah as well, because you can't have A more than B unless B itself is in that same category. But then the pasuk says, Vayar Hashem kisnua Leah, which is a very blunt term, but which the Mefarshim explained means relative to Rachel. She was the lesser beloved of the two. And then she has a child. And that's in Pasuk Lamed Beis. Perikav Tes Pasuk Lamed Beis. Vatahar Leah, Vatelet Bein, Vatikrosh Meruven, she's Reuven. And what does she say? Ki Amra, Ki Ra'a Hashem Be'onyi, Ki Ata Ye'ehovani Ishi. Hashem saw in my affliction, she was in pain, that Yaakov didn't relate to her the way that he related to Rachel. But Ki Ata Ye'ehovani Ishi. Now things will change. Why will things change now? Well, now she has borne him a son. Quite true. But she's still Leah. She's not Rachel. That's very interesting to note. As the Ksava Kabbalah points out, that when she says, Ki ato ye'ehovani ishi, now my husband will love me, the word ye'ehovani is not written the way it should be, all things being equal. Specifically, when you have a word like that, ahava or whatever it is, and then it's put into the future like that, it should be ki ato ye'ehaveni ishi. A point of comparison, when she has the vulun, she says, hapam yizbeleni ishi. That's the type of thing. Yizbeleni is like ye'ehaveni, it's the same thing. So the pasuk doesn't say ye'ehaveni, says ye'ehavani. Not something that we ourselves would have perhaps noticed. The Ksava Kabbalah notes it. What does it mean? So the Ksava Kabbalah says, here we have an example of a phenomenon that he detects throughout the Chumash, and it is absolutely fascinating. Namely, the Torah uses words to convey a message. And sometimes when the Torah wants to convey two messages, it will compact them into one word, so that the word will not come out, strictly speaking, the way grammar says it should, because there's much more going on in that word. Sometimes you get two words for the price of one. Mila morkeves, a composite word. It's an amazing thing. Classic example that we like to quote. When Moshe comes to the well in Midian, and Yisro's daughters are there, and the shepherds come and chase them away, but it says, and then Moshe helps them. Vayavo'u haro'im vayigarshum. That's the pasuk. Shmos perek beis. Vayavo'u haro'im vayigarshum. Says the Ksava Kabbalah, we're talking about seven daughters. I mean, they only get more feminine as they go along, and seven of them, the plural for feminine is not with a mem at the end, it's with a nun at the end. So the word isn't written the way grammar says it should be. It should say, Vayavo haro'im vayigarshun. They're all girls. So why does it write it, quote unquote, grammatically incorrectly? Says the Ksava Kabbalah, so open up the Medrash and open up Rashi and learn a bit about the background to that situation. You'll understand. Why are the Roim giving them such a hard time? Did they do anything wrong? It was because of Yisro. Yisro had abandoned their Avodah Zarah, so he'd fallen from grace. There's nothing as bad for morale as when the chief priest just throws the whole thing in. And he was a persona non grata, and his daughters were harassed because of that. So, says the Pasuk, Vayavo Haroim Vayigar Shum. The qualifying letter is masculine to tell us that this, the reason why is not because of them, it's because of him. That's a composite word. All of a sudden, it's two words for the price of one. Says the Ksava Kabbalah. The word should be Yehaveni. He will love me now. The Patach is there because the Patach is actually accurate or appropriate for the past tense. Ahavani. And when the Torah actually takes Yehaveni and Ahavani and turns it and puts them together as Yehavani, so that me, which is what it says, then that's telling us that Leah isn't saying, now he will love me, in the future only, but now he will realize that he should have loved me from the beginning. Why? Because Yaakov had misgivings. But Leah is saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if our union was not a blessed one, would not be blessed with a child. And therefore, now that I have a son, Yaakov will look back and say, perhaps I misjudged her from the outset, and Ata Ye'ehavani, based on what's happened now, the future will rewrite the past. And that's what the Torah communicates by changing the Tzere to a Patach. It's a different way of learning the Psukim altogether. The question is, why would he think that? Why would Yaakov keep Leah, in a sense, at a certain distance? Well, there could be many answers, and there probably are. It was only through deceit that she became his wife, and it caused complications because he always wanted to marry Rachel, and now they're two sisters, and even though the Torah hasn't been given, but it will yet come back to visit Yaakov, the fact that he married two sisters, even before the Torah was given. But Rebbe Hyman Zatzal explains something else. The point of Yaakov's relationship with Leah is that her default status, so to speak, is of the intended for Esav. That means that she is an appropriate person to marry Esav. She is not neutral in this equation. If she's not the zivug for Yaakov, she's the zivug for Esav. Esav certainly has misgivings about the nature of his brother Esav. Pardon me, Yaakov has misgivings about the nature of his brother Esav, and he ended up marrying Esav's wife. Well, what's she like? That's part of the background of the certain lukewarm atmosphere, which Leah seeks to redress. As she says, but now that we've had a child, that means HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given his haskama to the marriage, he will see that I broke away from Esav, and I have nothing to do with Esav, and I've entirely entrenched myself in Yaakov's camp, and have nothing to do with Esav anymore. And what's amazing is, this will give new insight. I mean, everyone knows the Gemara, and Rashi quotes it, and we've mentioned it many times, and until someone turns on the light, there are certain aspects that we don't appreciate. When she has her first son Reuven, she calls him Reuven and then says, Ki ra'ah Hashem ba'anyi, Hashem saw my affliction, quite true. But Rashi says something else and quotes it from the Gemara, that there's another reason behind the name Reuven. Reuven, see between. And what does that mean? Says the Gemara in Brachos Daf Zayin, quoted in Rashi, Re'u ma ben b'ni leben chami. See the difference between my son and my father-in-law's son. Who's her father-in-law? Yitzchak. And who's his son? Esav. See the difference between them. How so? Because Esav, he willingly and knowingly parted with his bechorah, as per last week, and still he held it against Yaakov for taking it from him. Whereas my son, his Bechorah will be taken from him against his will and given to Yosef, and not only will he not hold him against him, he will go out of his way to try and save Yosef. Now this Gemara is unbelievable in and of itself, because as reasons behind names go, You've got the rest of Chumash Bereishis that's compacted into Reuven's name. Many of these things Leah can't know. It's based on how her son will react when he loses the Bechorah. That incorporates the whole thing with after Rachel dies. And then the whole trouble with Yosef, the mind boggles. And that is why the Marsha says there is no question that we are dealing here with the subliminal level of Nevuah, which often Rashi discusses and the Chazal discuss, Nisnaba v'lo yodama Nisnaba. In other words, there's an element of Nevuah here, certainly in terms of the details. There's no way these details can be expressed. And that's why you won't find it in the Pasuk. As Chazal say, it's the background to the name, you won't find it in the Pasuk. How could she possibly describe any of this? But it is alluded to in the Pasuk, as the Vilna Gaon points out, because of all of the Shvatim, Reuven is the only one who actually has his name given, and then the reason is given afterwards. All of the other Shvatim, it says, she said the following and called him the following. So you see, it's a straight line, once again, sequentially, from the reason to the name. Reuven is the only one, he's called Reuven, and then you get the reason. That means that perhaps there's something else that led him to be called Reuven in the first place. Reuven. So there's so much to contemplate and ponder with regards to this statement of the Gemara, and Rashi quotes it, as we said. But an aspect that never occurred to me before, until I saw this week in the writings of Rav Hyman, is there's so many other things you could say in the positive about Reuven. In fact, moreover, it doesn't really sound like such a stellar compliment to say that he's better than Esav. If we go back to Parshas Noach, Bidorosav, if the only thing you can say is, well, you know, it could be worse, it could be Esav. I mean, that doesn't sound so good anymore. But that's what she said. See how different Meisen is from Esav? That's all you can say? Yeah, that's his only shining characteristic, is that he's not as bad as Esav? I mean, with compliments like that. But of course, the point is, Leah sees in the fact that she has a child now confirmation that she has broken away from Esav. And that's why she lays such heavy emphasis as the first child comes into Yaakov's family to show how he is the antithesis of Esav. Because that's further confirmation of the fact that she has nothing to do with Esav. And therefore, the most pertinent point is to contrast him and put a 100-foot pole between him and Esav. We have nothing to do with Esav. And see, on whatever level she was privy to these events, or what they represented, the difference between the two. Entirely new insight into why this was the matter emphasized over everything else. There is a comment that caught my attention. Again, it's a nuance issue, and there's so much to learn from paying attention to the way the psukim speak. In the end of Perek Lamed, where actually Yosef has been born, and, well, Yaakov is ready to go, and Pasuk Kafhe, Vayhi Kasha Yolda Rachel, as Yosef, and Rachel has given birth to Yosef, allow me to go. I'd like to go back home. Now, in the end, he doesn't end up going home just yet. He's been there for 14 years already. He will yet stay another 6, when that's the whole parsha to come. Lavan wants him to stay. Pasuk Kaf Zayin. Vayom Eilav Lavan. Im no matzah sichein be'inecha. If I found favor in your eyes, nichashti. I have done my divinations and concluded, Vayivarcheni Hashem biglalecha, Hashem has blessed me because of you. That's nice. That's a rare compliment from Lavan. Vayivarcheni Hashem biglalecha, everything I have is because of you. I mean, that's quite a moment. I guess he's desperate. But interestingly, He then says, Vayomar, Pasuk Kavches, Nokfos Chorcha Alai Ve'Teina. Name your price. I'll give it to you. Now, when Yaakov responds, Vayomar Elav, Hatoya Data is called Esa Shevadaticha, Vesa Shayamik Necha Iti. So Yaakov says, listen, you know I've worked for you hard. Ki ma'ata shaya lecha lefanai v'yifrotz l'rov. You gave me a few, they've become many. V'yivorach Hashem oscha l'ragli. And Hashem blessed you because of me, but now I'd like to go home. But Lavan doesn't let him go home. What's very interesting is, in the Sefer Kometz HaMincha, the drushes of Rav Chanoch Ehrentroy, the Tzal of Munich, he directs our attention to the fact that Lavan and Yaakov both refer to the bracha that has come to Lavan's house because of Yaakov, but in a slightly different way. Lavan says, Nichashti vayivachein Hashem biglalecha. Hashem blessed me because of you. Yaakov says, vayivorech Hashem oscha liragli. Now, liragli also has a connotation of, you know, because of me, like liragel hamlacha, right, as a result of. But he doesn't say biglali. What's the difference between biglal and lerega? That's the question. His answer is most fascinating. Lavan, we look upon this time when Lavan finally concedes that any bracha that he has is because of Yaakov. It's really a positive moment for Lavan. But there's a sting in the tail. There's a very dubious overtone here for the following reason. When a person like Lavan starts talking like a tzaddik, be on guard. And the reason why is because he's about to discuss terms with Yaakov. There is no question that his household has prospered as a result of Yaakov's presence there. And Lavan wants to talk about it in order to nullify it. How so? Because he says, I've looked into the matter, I've consulted my sources. Vayivarcheni Hashem biglalecha. Hashem blessed me because of you. And what does it mean, because of you? Just because you're you. As if to say, you're a holy man. You're a tzaddik. Bracha follows you wherever you go. Now that sounds amazing. But what Lava means to say is, and therefore don't expect to cash in on it, because you're not really doing anything in order for that bracha to accrue to you. You're just being holy. Well, you'd be holy anyway. So do you wish to commercialize your holiness? And turn it into money? Hashem has given me bracha. I don't doubt it. Biglalecha, because you're a holy man. And bracha follows you. You want me to pay you for that? Because you're so holy? So it started out looking as a wonderful compliment for Yaakov, is looking to say, don't turn that into a money-making enterprise, your holiness. And it's a terribly cynical thing that Lavan is saying. Because the implication is, you, Yaakov, bracha has come, but you didn't really do anything. It's very nice that you're holy, and I'm very happy that you're here. But I don't owe you anything. You didn't do anything for me. And that was ignoring and downplaying the real truth, which is that that Yaakov brought bracha into Lavan's house because he worked hard for him. And Lavan can't reconcile the two. You either work, if you work hard, it's because you're not holy. Because if you're holy, you shouldn't have to work. And Yaakov says, being holy means working hard. And that's why when he says, Hashem brought bracha vayivarech Hashem oscha liragli, it's because of what I did, not just because of what I am. I worked hard for you. And therefore, when we come to discuss terms, don't push it out of the way under for sacramental uses only. It's hard work and should be recognized as such. And those are two mindsets that continue. Classic insight from the Kometz HaMincha. I just wanted to conclude by referring to a Rashi. It's really been in my mind the last few days, certainly because of events as they have they are with us. And that's when Yaakov introduces himself, really, in Perek Kaftes Pasuk Yud Beis. This is when he first meets Rachel. Perek Kaftes Pasuk Yud Beis. Vayaged Yaakov leRachel, ki achi aviyahu. He told Yaakov to Rachel, he's her father's brother, which he is. I mean, cousin, certainly, nephew, really, to be more precise. V'chi ben Rivkahu. He's Rivka's son. V'toretz v'taged l'aviyah. Now, of course, there is an immediate redundancy because he's her father's brother, because he is Rivka's son. I mean, there are really two ways of saying the same thing. And that's why Rashi says. Rashi begins with the Pashtus, with the simple understanding. They're related. Achi aviyahu. But umidrash, but there's a medrash, because of the redundancy. Imlera ma'usu. What does it mean that he's her father's brother? Imlera ma'usu ba. If he's come to be deceitful with me, to trick me, I'm his brother. Gamani achi beramos. I can meet him. I can match him. V'im adam kashehu, but if he wants to be straight, he wants to be honest. Gamani ben Rivka, achosa kasher, I'm Rivka's son, I can do that as well. So in other words, Yaakov is kind of sending a message that whichever way he wishes to play it, you wish to be Lavan, I'm your brother. You want to be kosher, I'm Rivka's son, whichever way, it's up to you. And in a sense, when we finish the Rashi, as the Orachaim HaKadosh points out, we can't help but notice that Lavan certainly, there's no question as to which path he took. He took the Lavan path, and we don't really find that Yaakov matched him in that way. We don't really find that he got the better of Lavan every time. No, not really. Lavan managed to fool him a good few times. Yaakov is almost like he's just trying to survive. He's using all of his ingenuity just to... to block Lavan, but certainly he's not Lavan. He's not the master deceiver that he claimed that he was. But he said, he doesn't seem to be on a par with Lavan. So the Rechaim HaKadosh says, these two messages, these two ways of being, Achib Baramos and Ben Rivka, are not two alternative tracks. They both exist simultaneously. They coexist. Yaakov is saying, you're Lavan, and you're a deceitful person. Can I match wits with you? Yes, I can. Achiv Beramos. Does that mean I'm going to behave like you? No. Because I'm Rivka's son. So and in a sense, therefore, my parity of Ramos with you will have to be controlled within my ultimate definition as the son of Rivka. And therefore, if you try and fool me, I'm not going to fool you back, because I'm not going to become you. I can't. I'm a son of Rivka. I can match you, which means that I will look after myself and I will successfully defend myself. But I'm not going to do to you what you did to me. I can't do that. I'm capable of doing that. But I'm a son of Rivka. So really, I'm incapable of doing that. And therefore, that will give us the framework as to the way, the nature and extent of how I use my cunning to combat you. And from a certain point of view, that has become Jewish history. From that point onwards, Jews are, they can be as cunning as Lavan, but they can't afford to become like Lavan, because they're the sons of Rivka. And even when they're surrounded by Lavan, so their ingenuity, they could be Lavan 10 times better, but they can never ultimately compromise on their essential identity as the children of Rivka. And one could almost say the art of being a Jew is knowing how to match cunning with Lavan without losing out and selling out on being a son of Rivka. And that really continues to guide us. And the Mitzvah Hashem HaKadosh Baruch Hu should send bracha and have rachamim, and we shall have the service Torah's bekarov.